On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Nigerian playwright and social activist Wole Soyinka, Nobel Prize winner for literature, Africa's first, 20 years ago. He's out with a new memoir, You Must Set Forth at Dawn, and it is an intricate, dense story of political activism and artistry in a difficult place, in a difficult time. He's with me in the studio. Mr. Soyinka, thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
Here you are, still fighting after all these years. You just can't quit.
Well, I wouldn't call it fighting exactly. I just carry on business as usual.
Not fighting? It's just a matter of months ago, did I read you were in Lagos at some kind of protest? I mean, there you are.
All right. Yes, indeed. That's true.
There's so much we want to hear from you. Africa has been put in the news by some big public figures, President Bush, Bono, Jeffrey Sachs, you name it. And we want to try and understand. You know, the appeals come again and again. We see the problems in Darfur, in your own homeland of Nigeria. South Africa's made some progress, but yet the headlines are still so rough out of there. I wish you'd take us back for a moment to October 1st, 1960. You were a very young man, and your country was suddenly freed from British colonialism. What were your expectations in 1960?
Well, in 1960, we were very full of expectations, but at the same time, I must confess, some of us, at least, were cautious and filled with some trepidation. We're full of optimism simply because we saw ourselves as, I use the expression, as the Renaissance people. As a nation moved towards independence, we're convinced that the manpower and the will and the passion to reshape the nation would overcome any obstacles.
But the resources were great, the desire was great.
Everything was there, and we were very young and highly motivated. We'd gone and acquired the white man's secret, you know, by studying in England, so we'd seen the underside of the oppressor world, if you like, and had not scant respect for their right to even be lording it over any portion of the world. So, in other words, we were very full of confidence.
Do you remember how you imagined Nigeria and the other countries of Africa that were coming out of colonialism? What was your vision, your picture of how they would unfold? Would Lagos and other African cities one day look just like European cities? Would you have industry? And, you know, would they in effect become little Western or big Western equivalent countries? Is that what you anticipated?
No, in terms of industrialization, of course, we expected full industrialization with, however, a very keen consciousness of the authentic face of our own environment. In other words, we didn't expect the architecture to mimic Western architecture.
Sure.
In fact, I remember writing an article at the time, you know, condemning perpendicularism, which was a mark of the United States, and
the
saying
skyscraper.
That's right, and that we needed a very kind of, a kind of architecture which reflected designs, indigenous designs.
Mm-hmm.
No, so from that point of view, no, industrialized, yes, creating opportunities, job for, you know, the masses of the people. And at that time, there was very much, there was scope, really, for the expression, technological expression, humanistic expression, artistic expression. And this is what we saw as the future face of the continent. As far as politics was concerned, our dream, a major dream, was to go southwards and liberate Southern Africa.
Mm-hmm.
This was really the big motivating factor in our vision.
That was accomplished. It took a long time, and you were part of that effort, but so much else was not. I mean, in the decades since 1960, we look at what happened in Asia. People talk about the miracle. We look at Africa, and there's still so much struggle, accomplishments, but still so much struggle. Not the renaissance that you anticipated. It's too big a question, but help us just get our minds around why.
Well, let us recollect to start with. Let me blame the external factors first, and then I'll come internally. When the British left in Nigeria, for instance, they ensured that power was transferred to the section, which was, shall we say, least politically sophisticated, the more or less feudal section of the country.
Are you talking geographic or social class?
I'm talking about geographically now. That's the northern part, which still operated in many ways a kind of feudal system of governance.
Why would the British have an interest in leaving power to that portion of Nigeria?
Well, very simple. They felt the southern part was already too well versed in Western ways, shall we say, knew the secret of the British, and was prepared to contest the British holdings in Africa. Whereas there was less, shall we say, contemporary sophistication. This is not to say that the North was not sophisticated in its own way. I don't want to be misunderstood. But in terms of Western sophistication, the ability to interact on an equal basis, insist on a kind of equal partnership, equal
the kind that might challenge the British post-colonial era.
Yes. So the British actually, and this is admitted, by the way, by the in the memoirs of former British colonial servants, so it's not just Wale Soyinka saying this, they actually cooked the census and they cooked the first elections to ensure the power went to the feudal section.
Their gift to you, cooked books.
Yes. In fact, one of the district officers, former district officers, made the remark in his book that they shouldn't blame Africans for rigging elections, that it was the British who taught them how to rig elections, because he received orders to do so when he was a colonial officer in Nigeria.
So there's a kind of externality from the start left there just in census numbers, and I guess many others as well.
And the British, therefore, kept a kind of surrogate hold on Nigeria, dictating the terms of, shall we say, commercial relationships, and even trying to guide its politics towards the rest of the world. So a contest ensued rather bitterly between the part which had, quote-unquote, stolen, if you like, the election, but actually had been awarded the elections, and the section which felt that that part was dragging the rest of the nation back. So a lot of energy went into internal political, real intense political struggle. However, having said that, it is also a fact, we recognize that the first generation leaders, even many of those in the South, saw themselves merely as stepping into the shoes of the departing colonials. They were creatures of alienation. They wanted to lord it over the rest of the populace. In many instances, they did not really see themselves as partners in the development of the nation. Corruption began, you know, ballooned out of all proportion, and then to capital. We eventually found oil, which immediately distorted the multi-pronged productivity of the nation. We became a uni-product nation.
It sounds like a gift at first blush.
But
oil.
It was a curse. It was a curse. And I'm afraid that's the story of many parts of Africa, that the natural resources became a kind of blinding magnet for power, for the power seekers. And of course, they had the collaboration of the new multinational corporations who also believed in the myth of the strong man with whom they could make deals.
The one big man at the top.
Accountability, that's it. So it is both external and internal factors, I think, that have created the problems.
These are not just abstract concepts. The conflicts that Wale Soyinka looks at go on quite vividly. Let's just get some of that in our ears. Here's Alex Last, BBC reporter, reporting from Nigeria, Wale Soyinka's home country, on February 18th of this year.
Just before dawn, militants in speedboats launched an attack on this supply vessel, which is just near one of Shell's main oil facilities in the western Niger Delta. Now, the militants boarded the boat and they took the 9 foreign workers hostage. And it's just one of a series of attacks that they actually launched across the western Niger Delta. This is the group that last month held 4 foreign oil workers hostage for almost 3 weeks. Now, what they say they want is more local control of the oil wealth that is produced in the Niger Delta, and they say they want compensation from oil companies for pollution in the area.
And there it is, the BBC. You can hear the rebellion really underway underneath big oil in Nigeria right now. Wole Soyinka, what about the very current situation in your home country when it comes to oil? The whole world is looking at every source of oil these days, and the reports we hear are that your fellow Nigerians are suffering in that oil patch.
It's a very dire situation. And one feature of the last, I don't believe in hostage taking, but something rather good came out of this unfortunate experience, mm-hmm. some of the work, the hostages. Some of them were taken to the areas where the local people, the indigens, live. And the remarks which they made were most significant. They said they hadn't seen so much squalor. One of them particularly said, so we for the first time experienced the condition of the people from whose earth, you know, from whose soil all this wealth is taken, and it is a procedure of injustice.
Them saying this voluntarily after they've been hijacked off the oil rig or the oil ship, taken into the village, and this is how.
When they came out, this is what they said. And it's important to understand that these are highly motivated people, the MEND especially, you know, that's the
umbrella. The rebels in this area.
The rebels, yes. And I know some of, I've spoken to some of them. I was involved, actually, in the process of persuading them to release the hostages. Mm. And they are not the terrorists people, you know, the label given them by the president, though he no longer uses that language. He's sitting with them now because he realizes he has a real problem on his hands. And they're people who have long memories. Mm. They haven't forgotten the hanging of one of their greatest champions, the writer Ken Saro-Wiwa, mm-hmm. and his 8 Ogoni companions, you know, who were seeking just what they are seeking, justice, greater autonomy for the oil-producing areas, compensation by the oil-producing companies for the soil, the farmlands, which have been degraded, fishing ponds, toxified, the very air.
And remind us of their fate.
They were hanged by General Sani Abacha under trumped-up charges of murder, etc. They were hanged in spite of the protestations of the world and the African leaders, including Nelson Mandela. So with this kind of memory and this the decades of injustice, of neglect, it is not surprising that they become increasingly militant.
Ernest is calling from Augusta, Georgia. Hi, Ernest, you're on the air.
Yes. The question I have for you is, why the United States is not doing so much to help the Africans achieve good democratic governments in the continent, but so much is still pushed in the Middle East.
Ernest, you raise a lot there, but oil, the U.S., Africa, and democracy, how's the puzzle fit together?
Well, we have to be very careful here because the intervention, U.S. intervention in the name, in the cause of democracy, has not always yielded the best results. And there's no question whatsoever that not just the U.S., but the outside world, when they receive an appeal on behalf of democracy, yes, they must come to the aid. I believe it is their moral obligation. And they also have, these European nations also have restitution to make to the peoples of the African continent who've been brutalized by leaders with whom they had very close association. In fact, leaders whom they have propped in power despite their rejection by their own people. This myth of quote-unquote the strong man was something which really retarded the development, both political and economic development, of many nations in Africa for a very long time. Because all these nations and multinational corporations had to do was pick up the phone and make a deal above the heads of the people, the indigenes themselves. That's what's happening in the Delta today. And so while I agree with you that the U.S. has a moral obligation to come to the aid of the democratic movement on the African continent, we should be the ones to decide what kind of assistance that should be.
Does it matter that the power of intervention, the power of the purse may be shifting? from the UK, then to the US, and now to China. China's leader Hu has been in Africa just in the last few days, sort of making nice all over the place with big money and big deals, including in Nigeria. Does it matter? Does this portend better or worse times, in your view?
Well, in terms of having an economic a choice of economic partners, it certainly is an advance. I do not think that we're going to find that China is particularly interested in the democratic aspirations of the masses of the people. That'll be most unexpected. Let's just put it that way. So on the one hand, yes, we must diversify our system of partnerships, you know, our choices and so on. But when you come to issues like democracy, I think the fact is that we're more likely to look for assistance, as we did during the fight against Sani Abacha, towards Scandinavian countries, towards Western countries, towards the United States. Those happen to be the realities. Mm.
Ernest, thanks for your call. Si is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Si, you're on the air.
Hi, it's a privilege talking to you, Dr. Soyinka. My question is about Darfur on the genocide. What is your opinion? What are the causes? And what can be done to stop it immediately?
Wola Soyinka, Darfur.
Yes, Darfur is in everybody's mind at long last, thank goodness. There's global attention being paid, but not enough action being taken. The Sudanese government has been allowed to get away with murder, really, virtually, and rape. There's overwhelming evidence that it armed and unleashed the Janjaweed against the African peoples of Darfur. You ask the question, is oil involved? Well, when it was the northern-based government versus the south, yes, oil was definitely involved. I do not believe that any substantial amount of oil has been found in the western part, which is Darfur. And obviously, it's not a religious issue. So we're left only with the race factor. And it's not even a question of deduction. The documents taken from the Janjaweed, the pronouncements of the Quraysh, as they call Quraysh 1 and Quraysh 2, these directives actually talk about they do not mince words about the ethnic cleansing project which is on in Darfur.
Is the racial line so clear? Is there a color line between the attackers and those attacked in Darfur?
Yeah, I wouldn't base it on the color of the skin.
So it's ethnic?
It's ethnic. I wouldn't base it on the color of the skin at all. Mm-hmm. Because you have very black, dark, self-designated Arabs, mm-hmm. I mean, who actually participate mm-hmm. in this. So color won't help us.
So this is kind of ethnic.
It's an ethnic. It's a racial. It's an over exaggerated sense of race. That's what is happening in the Arab sector of Sudan. And the question you ask is, in fact, one which I have raised myself. Mm. What is the Arab League doing? Sudan has one leg in the African world and has one leg in the Arab world. It's a member of the Arab League and it's a member of the Africa Union.
And the Arab League was meeting in Khartoum recently, seeming by that to sanction.
Yes, and in fact, our commission, we were going to, the Elie Wiesel Foundation for Humanity, mm-hmm. was going to send a small commission, of which I was a member, to Khartoum. Mm. And at the last moment, permission was to Darfur. At the last moment, permission was withdrawn on the grounds that the Arab League was about to meet.
Right. And their preparations. Bad timing.
All right. And so the question on my mind, on the mind of all of us, one which I have voiced publicly, is what is the Arab League going to decide about its renegade member, the government of Sudan? Because this is not just an African problem. It's a global problem. But after the primary responsibility of Africa Union, the next in line is the Arab League.
But they're clearly not standing up to be helpful here.
They're not.
What's the solution?
Speaking up loud enough. Well, I think pressure, first of all. First of all, the situation must be globalized. Africa Union has proved that while its feelings are in the right place, it lacks the means to protect millions of people. And therefore lacks the means to bring the Sudanese government to heel.
You want soldiers from outside Africa in Darfur?
It should become a United Nations responsibility. And I would like to see the Arab League volunteering its resources and its manpower to the United Nations as the frontline peacekeepers in that area. I think it's got to show a sense of moral responsibility.
Do you see any chance of that actually happening?
Frankly, I do not. But that does not mean that we must not demand it. We have to demand it. We have to place the family of which Sudan is a member on notice.
One of your early works, Death and the King's Horsemen, tells a story that's sort of tied up in African tradition and maybe even mythology. Which would you remind us of that story and your complaint with the way a British officer intervened in tradition here and its significance?
Well, the first thing is we must remind ourselves of the many cultures within Africa itself.
Of course.
Talk of African
vast
culture. And in this particular part of Africa, that's in Nigeria, in Western Nigeria, in the area, or your area.
Your there home terrain.
Not far from my hometown, in fact. Mm-hmm. There was an incident many decades ago where the king's horseman, or rather, more literally, the keeper of the king's horse, mm-hmm. tradition was that after the king died, he was supposed to commit ritual suicide to accompany him to the other world. Mm-hmm. And in this instance, the British officer, district officer, intervened to stop this ritual suicide. And what happened was that the son, who was then outside the country, yeah, he was actually trading in Ghana at the time, came home thinking that he had to, you know, bury his father because he knew what the routine was, mm-hmm. was so shocked at seeing his father
still alive. The king's horseman had not gone on to the other world.
No, he refused to. Sensible man. So he committed suicide. However, the issues involved are, of course, issues of intervention, you know, in a structure which, you know, right or wrong, still is the kind of system of belief that holds a community together. And also a question of honor. Do you, if you have a bargain, do you keep it or not, even if it's considered a feudal kind of carryover or whatever? So it's that drama which I tried to expose on the stage as a tragedy.
And what piqued my interest in that was now we live in a globalizing world. We feel perhaps freer than ever to judge one another across national boundaries and cultural lines. You pass judgment across national borders and cultural lines. Everyone does these days. And yet in this play, Death and the King's Horsemen, you, it seems in a way like a warning against intervention in another culture where we may not organically relate to some deep, important drama that's unfolding. So are there limits to judgment across cultures that are reasonable? And I guess an extension of that, do you today suggest that Africa will or must develop in its own way despite globalization?
Well, I've always insisted that culture is anything but static. On the contrary, it's very dynamic. Mm-hmm. And culture changes. It evolves. And the best form of evolution is an organic one, an evolution and changes that come from within. There are many ways in which one can judge, one can intervene in, as I said, a kind of the cultural system or acceptances of another. But never, should never be from the position of arrogance and superiority. The arguments which are given to both sides of this drama, you notice, are I think they're pretty. They pretty match one another. The district officer in this case actually extracts from within the culture the sayings of that society mm-hmm. to challenge Elesh's beliefs mm-hmm. when he's a prisoner.
This and is actually, the British colonial officer challenging the local belief.
Yes, and extracting, you know, basing his argument on a very critical Yoruba saying, and actually silences the
Yoruba
champion.
The local culture, the culture,
the collective culture mm-hmm. of that whole area. Mm-hmm. So you see, both sides are actually presenting their own arguments, mm-hmm. and I don't think I beyond the whittling down, you know, the arrogant position mm-hmm. of the Pilkins, making him now seek the validation of his arguments from within that culture.
Rather than from outside,
precisely. Mm-hmm. And he bests Elesh Nyoba, the would-be suicide person, mm-hmm. he bests him in that argument. Mm-hmm. And in any case, one doesn't have to believe in a particular form, act of culture, to be able to create drama out of conflict which exists. And I'm a dramatist. And that for me is really a muse-donated kind of conflict which I could not pass by.
And let's remember, says Wallaceyanka, culture itself very dynamic, and perhaps in few times as much as right now globally. Shiji is calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Shiji, you're on the air.
Hello, how are you, sir?
Very well.
Very well.
Brother Wale, this is one of the Adelubas.
Ah, how are you?
Very thankful, sir.
Wonderful,
I was just
dear,
hearing that since things fell apart, our culture fell apart also. And to hear you still working hard for the freedom of not just Nigeria, but Africa in general, and the people of the African diaspora, is a great commendation. And I just wanted to pass that on.
There it is.
Just wanted to...
Applause for you.
Oh, thank you very much.
Here,
so there was no question. Okay, and, well, his prejudice. I know his uncle.
Yeah, well, he's not the only one who's prejudiced. Shiji speaks of the African diaspora. You have at different times been part of that, sometimes involuntarily in exile, other times voluntarily. I was struck by how tightly the threat, though, from Africa has followed you sometimes. You describe a time when in Atlanta, when you were afraid for your life during the regime of Sani Abacha, that the Nigerian government might reach out in the United States and kill you here, so much so that you left town.
Well, they not might. We had solid evidence, and in fact that has been confirmed by one of the masterminds of Abacha's killer squad, who's still on trial at the moment, that they did send their agents outside. And we got that information, all right. Not only that, they went so far as to create a special consulate to sort of service their agents outside.
To open one, it in Atlanta,
to operate,
where you were at Emory University at
that's
that time.
Right. One
maybe
was in
just
Houston.
For you.
That's right. One was in Houston and the other was in Atlanta. And since I was traveling so much, you know, I was not so much afraid for myself as for my family, who were left unprotected any time I traveled outside. Mm-hmm. So I moved them to the other side of the continent. And I pretended, with the connivance of the president of my university and my head of department, that I was still living in Atlanta. So I'd come in, give my lectures, move out, stay at the conference center hotel, and that's the way we managed. It was part of the... In fact, I think they should name that consulate after me, you know, since it was created especially for me.
The Wallaceyanka Honorary Consulate in Atlanta,
yes,
of Nigeria.
I think they should.
The note to the Nigerian Foreign Office. So many details in this memoir that really turned the head. I mean, you mentioned the British rigging of the first democratic elections after independence. I mean, the CIA's hands in here, and the literary journal Transition in Africa, how General Abacha's security operation run by Israelis, death squads trained by Korea, you allege. Is this network of international intervention still so active in Nigeria, or with its oil wealth, does it throw that off? Does it have its own means for good or ill?
You know, I have a feeling that the network of intervention will be with us for quite a while, for the simple reason that the kind of leaders we're having usually seem not to trust their own people. And that's for good reason. It's like our present leader who... president who's trying to manipulate and subvert the constitution to give himself a third term.
Yes.
Turn himself into another Mugabe or whatever he has in mind.
This is President Obasanjo trying to go further.
Yes, and it's this which, knowing very well that what they're doing is against the wishes of the people, that's what makes them rely on the security of other nations.
Chris is calling from Sherburne, Massachusetts. Hi, Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, good to talk to you. I'm curious, especially from the playwright's perspective. I'm a playwright myself, working with the idea that people, especially men, seem to go for the machete or the gun before they go for negotiation. We tend to, all over the world, we tend to respect the might of the leader rather than the rule of law or the rule of past wisdom. And, well, I'd just like to get Mr. Soyinka's perspective on that.
Well, power, as you know, is very intoxicating, and some people are far more, you know, they have a weaker head for power than others for that intoxicant. And so they rely on brute force to remain remain within that ambience of power, control, domination, utilizing any resource. Generally outside the law, of course, because they are ruling against the will of the people. We've had exceptions, of course. You've had people like President Nyerere. You had people like Konare, who's the present Secretary General of the Africa Union, those who actually bowed out at the end of their term of office. You had people like Senghor, for instance, who even bowed out before, even though he was still entitled to continue in office. So those positives are models to be looked up to. Unfortunately, the ones who do the greatest harm naturally get the greatest attention.
And our playwright caller asks you, who have done both, which is more effective, to pick up the gun or pick up the pen?
What is more effective? It all depends on circumstances. I don't hold very much to that saying that the pen is mightier than the sword. Sometimes, yes, the pen is mightier than the sword. But you saw, for instance, in the case of the writer Ken Saro-Wiwa and his 8 companions, they were hanged by the sword, by the man
violence.
Who wielded the sword at the moment. When you're confronted with a situation like that, what do? Do you write more poems, or do you also pick up the gun? That is a dilemma that has stayed with creative people throughout history, and I think will continue to stay with us, that when you have state terror, it usually results in counter-terror by the people, or at least a kind of resistance which involves the pen. Christopher Okibo, a writer, during the Biafran War, he was an Igbo. He felt that his people had been decimated, and it was true. His people had been a victim of a campaign of genocide. And at that moment, he decided that the pen was no longer of any use. He took up the gun, and he perished on the war front. I think we have to understand and respect these decisions. It's always an individual choice, ultimately.
Our time grows short. There's so much I'd like to ask you. The Washington Post was following you around a couple of days ago and reported on an exchange you had with a young man in one of your appearances where he was pushing you on the issue of whether race is really just a construction, a kind of artificial construction. And your sort of famously impish but deep sense of humor came back when he brought your book, your memoir, to him. You signed it, and you, as reported in the Post, wrote in his book, "Race is also an act of will." What do you mean by that? And what are you supporting by that?
Well, it's Darfur is an example where you cannot really immediately define race. But when the issue comes of choice, you do make a choice. In other words, it's like passing. Mm-hmm. A seemingly white person who's got, you know, who's really black can decide as an act of will, I am white. And I believe that is that individual's choice. The young man, for instance, who was pushing me about that, actually, I saw his dilemma and I did not want to personalize it. Mm-hmm. He was a mixture. Mm-hmm. He was half white, half black. And I could see what his problem was. And I did not want to personalize this.
Understood.
At all, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But what I said to him, what I scribbled that to him, person to person, was, I hoped he would understand the message, that it's his decision. It's an act of will on his part to decide whether he was half of whatever he apparently was, or the other half, that it's an issue for him.
Exercise your will, young man.
Yes,
decide.
That's really what I meant by what I scribbled there.
So here we are, all these years, and now another memoir. You say your last?
Definitely. Well, I've said that before. I know, but I hope it's my last. It's a burden, you know. I really still believe that one shouldn't write one's biography after the age of innocence. That really is my conviction.
It's a young man's game. That's gone. You've done it one more time, and we're grateful for it.
Thank you.
Willa Soyinka's new memoir is You Must Set Forth at Dawn. Willa Soyinka, we're honored to have you with us today. Thank you very much indeed, and good luck to you.
Thank you. It's been a stimulating discussion.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation. Download the On Point podcast or subscribe to our daily newsletter, all at our website, onpointradio.org. We'll go out once again with Fela Kuti, cousin of Willa Soyinka. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Balava, he could get you.